Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. This is week 2 of the May 2024 Model Railroader magazine. Today we will be reading the following articles: News and Reviews, Ask Model Railroader, and Prototype to Model. News and Reviews section. Atlas N-Scale H24-66 Trainmaster. Atlas Model Railroad Company recently released a new run of its N-Scale Fairbanks Morse H26-44 Trainmaster diesel locomotive. The six-axle road locomotive, part of the Atlas product lineup since 2000, is now offered with a factory-installed speaker, Silver Series, or a dual-mode ESU Lock Sound V5 sound decoder, Gold Series. Fairbanks Morse produced the H26-44 Trainmaster from April 1953 to June 1957. During that time, the Beloit, Wisconsin-based company produced 105 units for U.S. railroads and 22 for Canadian lines. The sample we received is decorated as Erie Lackawanna 1854. The prototype was built as Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western 854. Following the October 1960 merger between the DL&W and Erie, the unit became EL 1854. After the merger, the diesel was repainted yellow and black. In the mid-1960s, it was repainted in the scheme depicted on the Atlas model. The unit was retired in 1968. The Atlas H26-44 has a multi-piece plastic shell consisting of the body, cab, and sill unit. The body is offered in Phase 1A, 1B, and 2 versions. The E-L is a Phase 1A. Most of the details on the shell are molded. Freestanding plastic details include the handbrake and two single-chime air horns. A pair of etched metal grills cover the radiator fans near the front of the long hood. Molded fans are visible under the screens. Probably the biggest change to the Trainmaster is the die-cast metal chassis. Unlike previous releases that used a split-frame chassis, the latest run features a solid chassis. A trough milled down the center of the chassis houses the motor, two brass flywheels, drive shafts, and worm gears. A metal cap, attached with four screws, spans those parts. The printed circuit, or PC board, is secured to the metal cap with two screws. The decoder is located above the rear truck. The rectangular speaker is above the front truck. Wires run from wheel wipers to JST connectors that plug into sockets on the bottom of the PC board. Another pair of wires go from a JST connector/socket on top of the board to the motor contacts. I compared the model to drawings published in the Model Railroader Cyclopedia, Volume 2, Diesel Locomotives, Kalmbach, out of print. Most of the major dimensions follow published data. However, the length of the long hood is a scale 9 inches too short. The short hood is approximately a scale 8 inches too short. The sample we received has an ESU Lock Sound V5 sound decoder. I ran the model on our workshop test track using an NCE power cab. At step 2, the locomotive moved at 2 scale miles per hour. At step 28, the unit topped out at 66 scale miles per hour. The maximum speed of the prototype Trainmaster was 66 to 79 miles per hour, depending on the gear ratio. If the upgraded N-Scale Trainmaster is any indication, Atlas Model Railroad Company isn't resting on its laurels as it celebrates its centennial. Even though the Fairbanks Morse H26-44 has been in the manufacturer's master line for nearly a quarter century, the crew in Hillside, New Jersey, has found innovative ways to keep this popular prototype up to speed with the latest trends in the hobby. Signed, Cody Grivno, Senior Editor. Facts and Features. Price. Direct current model with factory-installed speaker, $139.95, with dual-mode ESU Lock Sound V5 sound decoder, $249.95. Manufacturer, Atlas Model Railroad Company, located at 378 Florence Avenue, Hillside, New Jersey, 07205, or shop.atlasrr.com. Era, mid-1960s to June 1968, as decorated. Road names, Phase 1A, Erie Lackawanna, Chihuahua Pacific, and Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western. Phase 1B, Jersey Central Lines, Reading Company, and Southern Pacific. Phase 2, Canadian Pacific and Pennsylvania Railroad. 2 to 3 road numbers per scheme. Features. Blackened metal wheel stubs mounted on plastic axles, N-gauge. Body-mounted Accumate couplers at correct height. Minimum radius, 9.75 inches. Weight, 3.7 ounces. Tangent HO Southern Pacific Boxcar. A line of Pullman Standard Southern Pacific Lines 40-foot 6-inch post-war boxcars is now available from Tangent Scale Models. Designed from PS blueprints and field measurements of full-size cars, the HO scale models include prototype-specific details, New American Steel Foundry's 50-ton A3 ride control trucks, and KD scale couplers. Many railroads looked to improve their boxcar fleets at the end of World War II, and Southern Pacific, along with subsidiaries St. Louis Southwestern, Cottonbelt, and Texas and New Orleans, were no exception. Between the end of the war and 1953, SP added more than 19,000 40-foot boxcars to its roster. The sample we received is decorated as SP-102230, part of the railroad's 102100 through 103599 series, built by PS under purchase order P-3057 between September and December 1950. The full-size car was part of SP's B-50-28 class, the largest in its post-war boxcar fleet. SP had 3,000 cars, and subsidiary TNNO rostered 1,500 cars. The Tangent Scale Model's HO post-war boxcar has a one-piece injection-molded plastic body with many separate, factory-applied parts. The B-50-28 model features a see-through apex brake running board with wire corner grab irons. Freestanding details on the sides and ends of the car include bracket-style grab irons, 8-rung ladders, stirrup steps, and placard and root boards. The B end of the car features an apex brake step, universal handbrake housing, and minor handbrake. The B-50-28 model is fitted with 7-foot Youngstown doors. Though the doors are individual pieces, they're not positionable. The underbody is a separate plastic casting with molded floorboard and stringer detail. The draft gearboxes, center sills, body bolsters, bolster blocks, cross ties, and cross bearers are cast as a single unit. Other features include wire uncoupling levers and rubber air hoses. The air reservoir, brake cylinder, and control valve are all separate parts. An assortment of formed metal and plastic pipes, rods, levers, and hangers round out the underbody details. Our sample is decorated in SP's 1950 on as delivered scheme with Roman style lettering. The boxcar red paint is evenly applied, and the placement of the graphics follows prototype images that I found in books and online. The model's dimensions closely follow data published in the January 1959 Official Railway Equipment Register, Railway Equipment and Publication Company. The boxcar rides on American Steel Foundry's 50-ton A-3 ride control trucks with 33-inch metal wheel sets. The trucks, which have separate brake beam detail, are molded to match the body color and have raised foundry data. To see how the car performed in an operating environment, I put the car in a transfer run from Milwaukee to Jones Island on our Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy staff layout. The boxcar comfortably navigated the layout's 24-inch radius curves and number 6 turnouts. The full-size Southern Pacific post-war 40-foot 6-inch boxcars could be found throughout North America, and Tangent Scale Models offers many versions to cover the service lives of these cars. If you model any time between 1950 and the 1970s, you'll want to get a few of these cars for your freight car fleet. Signed, Cody Grivno, Senior Editor. Facts and features. Price, $52.95. undecorated kits, $50.95. Manufacturer, Tangent Scale Models, P.O. Box 6514, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816, or tangentscalemodels.com. Era, 1950 to 1970s, as decorated. Road names, Southern Pacific, as delivered 1950 on, Class B-50-28, as delivered 1953 on, Class B-50-32, with Texas and New Orleans reporting marks, and 1960 on, repaint. And St. Louis Southwestern, as delivered 1951 on, 6 to 12 road numbers per scheme, undecorated kits, 1965 on and 1968 on, rebuilt bodies, both with 10-foot doors, and painted SP boxcar red, but unlettered, 5 and 7 panel superior door and Youngstown door, also available. Features, 33-inch metal wheel set, engage, Katy scale couplers at correct height, weight, 4.7 ounces, 0.9 ounces too heavy per National Model Railroad Association recommended practice 20.1. Now, the Ask Model Railroader section by Stephen Ott. Why is there an F on the front of diesels? Question. I am wondering about the little F mark on a diesel. I know it stands for front. However, isn't it obvious in most cases where the front is? And in the case of a center cab switcher, where it isn't at all obvious, why does it matter? What is the practical purpose of being able to tell at a distance which end of the locomotive is the front? Signed, Mark Faust. Answer. While it may be obvious on an old covered wagon or a modern cowl unit which end is the front, that's not the case for all diesels. Most first-generation hood units were configured long hood forward. Though most railroads switched to running their electromotive division Jeeps and SDs short hood forward when low short hood units came out, others, such as the Southern Railway and Norfolk Southern, continued running theirs long hood forward. The most common explanation for this practice is that it was a safety issue. Putting more metal in front of the crew in case of a head-on collision was something on the tracks. And almost all Alco road switchers were set up to run long hood forward. So why does it matter to a person on the ground which end of a locomotive is the front? Again, the answer is safety. When a locomotive is ready to move, regulations say that the engineer is supposed to signal with his horn or whistle to warn those working nearby. Three short blasts of the whistle means the locomotive is about to start backing up. When a trainman hears this signal, he's going to want to be able to look at the engine and know which direction it's about to go. There are also practical reasons, such as being able to tell if an engine is facing the right way to pick up its train, or whether it has to be turned on the turntable first. But safety is the primary reason. Question. What is the rule of thumb for the transition from a grade back to level when laying track? By Carl Engdahl. Answer. Gradual transitions between track grades, called vertical track easements, can help prevent problems on your model railroad. If a train suddenly goes from a steep grade to flat track or vice versa, couplers can shift above or below each other, especially if the cars are of different lengths. The train could simply split apart at that point, or worse, the couplers could get hung up on each other and cause a derailment. Another possible problem is that long cars could bottom out on a vertical curve, getting its underbody caught on the point where the track starts the downgrade. The solution is to make the curve more gradual. In other words, a vertical track easement. Try to make the distance over which the grade changes at least 1.5 times the length of your longest car or locomotive. That way, you can never have two pieces of adjacent rolling stock on both slopes at the same time. One of them will always be in transition. If you use thick plywood, 1/2 inch or 3/4 inch, for your subroad bed, you shouldn't have that much of a problem with vertical kinks. The plywood's resistance to bending will ensure your vertical transitions are gentle. However, there are situations where you still have to be careful about introducing vertical kinks. The first is subroad bed joints. Avoid situating joints between pieces of subroad bed plywood where the track changes grades. Move those joints 2 or 3 feet to one side so they fall where the track is flat. If you must situate a joint at a grade transition, splice another piece of plywood at least 2 feet long under the joint to give it rigidity. Likewise, avoid placing track joints at grade transitions. Even if your sub-roadbed has a nice gentle transition, roadbed and track can pull up from the sub-roadbed over time, introducing a vertical kink. Position rail joints on even grades if at all possible. Problems can also occur if you're using pre-cut foam sub-roadbed risers for your grades. Use a plywood plane, rasp, or foam cutter to knock the sharp corners off of the tops of slopes and add slivers of foam or cork at the bottom of the grade to make the transition more gradual. Finally, track can change grades suddenly where a spur or siding transitions from mainline elevation to ground level. Use a rasp or sanding block to gradually shave your cork roadbed down to ground level over a distance at least as long as your longest car. Question: my N-scale train layout uses Kato Unitrack and is controlled by two identical direct current or DC power packs. One runs the main line while the other operates the yard. When I attempt to move a train from the main to the yard or vice versa, the train stops at the junction between blocks. Both power packs are aligned so the train should be going in the same direction at the same speed, yet the train stops. The main and yards are separated by double insulated rail joiners, so there should be no electricity leaking from one power pack into the other's jurisdiction. What am I doing wrong? Signed, Irv Soden, Vestal, New York. Answer: you might think that isolating the main from the yards with insulated rail joiners would keep the two wiring blocks separate, but when a locomotive crosses from one block to the other, it bridges that gap. Since electrical pickups from both trucks feed to the locomotive's motor, the engine creates a short between the two power packs. Your power packs must be sensing the short and shutting down when that happens, protecting the locomotive. What you need to do is guarantee that an engine never bridges a gap between blocks controlled by two different power packs. You can accomplish this by installing a few double-pull, double-throw, or DPDT switches between your power packs and your wiring blocks. You need to wire them so that either power pack can control either block. When you want to send a train into or out of the yard, flip the switches so both blocks are controlled by the same power pack. Drive the train so all the locomotive's wheels are completely in the other block, then, and only then, flip the switch to give control over to the other power pack. If you want to be able to control both parts of your layout simultaneously and hand off locomotives from one to the other on the fly, you need to create a third, separate track block between the two. This transition block needs to also be wired with a DPDT switch, so it can be controlled by either power pack. Flip the switch so the transition block is controlled by the same power pack as the block where the train is. Drive the locomotive forward into the transition block, then switch the block to control of the other power pack. Look up the article, How to Wire a Layout for Two-Train Operation, in our July 2011 issue for more about wiring your railroad for DC block control. You'll find even more information in Larry Puckett's book, Wiring Your Model Railroad, available in the Kalmbach Hobby Store, kalmbachhobbystore.com/product/book/12491. Question: I recently received my copy of Jerry Leone's Model Railroaders Handbook, also available in the Kalmbach Hobby Store edition. In the Railroad Regulatory Timeline article on page 111, most of the regulations banned older, unsafe technology, parentheses, arch bar trucks, truss rod car construction, etc., end parentheses, as newer equipment was developed. That made sense to me, but I noticed that in 1937, billboard reefers were banned. I can't imagine what the motivation for banning such cars could have been. Can you shed any light on this? Signed, Chris Santee. Answer: billboard reefer cars were only kind of banned. What was banned was the practice that made them profitable. The issue was complex, so I asked Kalmbach book author and railroad historian Jeff Wilson for clarification. A billboard car is one usually belonging to a leasing company, not a railroad, that's emblazoned with often large and splashy advertisements touting the products it carried. Sometimes, the billboard advertised a product unrelated to the car or the business it served. Usually it was a refrigerator car, but there were a few billboard box cars, and oil tank cars fell under the same rules. When a rail car is on the rails of a railroad different from the car's owner, the railroad must pay a daily fee, called a per diem, to the car's owner. In addition, if the car's owner is not another railroad, but for instance a car leasing company, the railroad also pays the car's owner a mileage charge based on how far the car moves. Obviously, the railroads would rather not have to pay this fee, but since shippers could request what car they wanted to carry their goods, railroads had little choice but to use leased cars. Back in the 1920s, leasing companies found what they thought was a swell way to increase business. They would pay a portion of the mileage charge they got from the railroads back to the shippers as a rebate for requesting their cars. Lessors started painting their cars with big, showy advertisements for the shippers' products, like Rath hams, Land O'Lakes butter, and Budweiser beer. The shippers liked this because it meant extra money for them, plus advertising. The leasing companies liked it because their cars got more mileage. Who didn't like it? The railroads, who were the ones paying the rebate by being forced to use mileage rate cars instead of their own. Plus, since a lot of refrigerator car lines were associated with or even outright owned by the shippers were essentially double-dipping at the railroad's expense. Not to mention, shippers such as Hormel Meats didn't appreciate it when a reefer bearing a third-party advertisement, like Old Dutch Cleanser, showed up at their loading docks. So the railroads took their case to the Interstate Commerce Commission, which in 1934 banned the rebate scheme and banned cars with billboard advertisements from interchange service starting in 1937. Cars could still bear the names and logos of the shipper leasing the car, such as Anheuser-Busch, but not specific products like Budweiser. Third-party ads were also banned. With the rebate gone, the incentive for elaborate paint schemes also disappeared. Since wood-sided refrigerator cars required frequent repainting, billboard reefers were gone from the rails within a few years of the ICC's ruling. Question: do you know of a cement or glue that works with polypropylene plastic? By Curtis Elkin. Answer: the Loctite plastics bonding system is compatible with various plastics that are difficult to bond, including polypropylene, polyethylene, and polytetrafluoroethylene. The two-part Loctite plastics bonding system contains an activator slash primer and glue. Before using the products, make sure the parts that need to be glued are clean and dry. Then, working in a well-ventilated area and wearing eye and hand protection, apply the activator slash primer to both gluing surfaces and wait 60 seconds. Next, apply the glue to one gluing surface and press the parts together. Hold the joint for 30 seconds. I've had good luck using the Loctite plastics bonding system to repair broken handrails on diesel locomotives. You can find the two-part system at most big box retailers, hardware stores, and home improvement centers for less than $10. Signed, Cody Grivno, Senior Editor. The next section is Prototype to Model. C&NW's Waseca, Minnesota yard in the 1970s. The prototype photo seen at right was taken by Tom Fleming in July 1971 at the Chicago and Northwestern Engine Facility at Waseca, Minnesota. Engine 167, an Alco RS-3 built in 1953, is parked next to the fueling stand. At the far right of the photo are the sand tower and sand drying house. I used this photo and several others by Tom to model in detail my HO-scale Waseca engine facility. The model photo was taken on my prototype-based model railroad. The layout is based on the CNNW's Winona subdivision, which ran from Winona, Minnesota to Waseca in 1976. The model of engine 167 was built using a Stewart RS-3 Phase 2 shell kit. The drive from an Atlas RS-3 was used to power the model. A scratch-built chassis made from brass shapes was designed to fit the Stewart shell and Atlas drive components. The handrails were made from bronze wire, brass bar, and KV models side handrail stanchions. The fuel tank and air reservoirs were scratch-built from styrene. The RS-3 was painted using Model Master acrylic paint and weathered using an airbrush. A small amount of chalk powder was also used for weathering. The utility pole next to the fueling stand was made using parts from a Rix kit. The fueling stand was scratch-built from brass and styrene shapes. The sand tower and sand house in the background were scratch-built from styrene. The track is hand-laid using Micro Engineering Code 70 rail and Mount Albert Scale Lumber Company wood ties. The track was weathered with poly-scale oily black acrylic paint using an airbrush. To model the oil spills around the fueling stand, several coats of Pledge with Future Shine acrylic floor wax was applied between the rails and around the fuel station. The sand piles around the rails were made using very fine wood sanding dust. Sill floor 6mm late summer static grass and fine ground foam was used to make the weeds. Dennis Eggert is a charter member of the Chicago and Northwestern Historical Society who lives in East Central Wisconsin. His HO scale CNNW Alco Lines East layout appeared in Model Railroad Planning 2023. This article was by Dennis Eggert. Send us your scenes. Have you modeled a scene based on a prototype photo? Email both the prototype and model photos, along with a description of the scene and modeling technique shown, to Senior Associate Editor Stephen Ott at sotte@kallenbach.com. Be sure to put, quote, prototype to model, end quote, in the subject line. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at aftersight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.